This is a special edition of the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Welcome to this special edition of the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Unlike regular episodes where we have co-hosts, a guest, and a number of segments, special editions have a single topic. They are usually meant for interviews or extended reports that are too long for our regular show. We really hope you enjoy this Airplane Geeks Podcast special edition, and let's get started. Hi, this is Max Flight. I'm at the AOPA Aviation Summit in Hartford, Connecticut. And this is actually day two as I'm recording this. But, you know, this has been a fantastic event. I've spent the last day and a half so far strolling through the exhibitor areas, and I've also attended a few of the seminars. In the exhibiting areas, there's a huge number of companies represented here of all different sorts. And lots of attendees, of course, wandering through. So what I've done is spend some time talking to some of the exhibitors about what they're offering, what they have going on, what's new, what's coming. And I've also talked to a few of the attendees about their experiences at this event. One thing that strikes me is the passion for aviation that's exhibited here. And, you know, that's probably no great surprise because people who are involved in aviation tend to be very passionate about it. But it's really kind of exciting to be immersed in a crowd of folks that, you know, share some common interests and in that common passion. So that's been exciting. Another observation is a lot of companies are embracing kind of, you know, newer, I'll call them media devices, iPhones, iPads, Android tablets of, you know, various sorts, things like that. I'm seeing quite a bit of that kind of thing. Sometimes it's just accessories, iPad holders for, you know, use in the cockpit and things like that. Many of the vendors that sell software of various sorts, you know, also have iPad versions now. So that's a real kind of growing trend. So again, it's been an exciting event. I would definitely advise that anyone interested in aviation, if you have a opportunity to attend an AOPA aviation summit, you know, try to get to one. It's great. It's not, you know, overly large. It shares some of the same features that you know might find in larger shows, but on a kind of a smaller scale. It's kind of a very pleasant size. So with that, what I've got is a series of interviews. They're very short, 3-4 minutes each. But it's worth going through all of them, even if it's on a topic that you're not particularly interested in. Sometimes the comments are interesting, even if it isn't an area that you're particularly interested in. So I invite you to listen to them all, and it won't take that long. So I'll leave it with that, and hope you enjoy the interviews. I'm at the Aviation Safety Reporting System booth, the ASRS. We've talked about this on the podcast before, but let's find out a little bit more information. Who am I speaking with?
My name is Don Purdy. I'm with the, as you said, the Aviation Safety Reporting System. It's an FAA program that was set up back in 1976, and it's run by NASA as a disinterested third party from the FAA.
And the purpose of the program is...
Generally speaking, it's to, if we all make mistakes,
sure.
And if you make a mistake while you're flying, or you see, you don't have to necessarily be making a mistake. If you see a safety item that you think ought to be brought forward, you can submit a report to the ASRS program. And if you, in fact, have violated an FAR or something, it's going to give you immunity.
Now, who can submit reports? Pilots?
Anyone.
Anyone.
It could be a passenger on an airplane. It could be maintenance. It could be air traffic control.
Oh, interesting. And what happens to the issues once they're submitted?
Well, it goes into our system, we have a group of analysts, expert analysts, who are air traffic controllers, they're maintenance types, they're pilots, and every report is screened twice initially, and then from there they go, they're sorted into whether or not there's data in there that needs to be looked at even further, and then it'll go to an individual analyst who goes through it all, and then it goes into the database.
Can you give us just quickly a couple of examples of the kinds of problems that might get reported?
Well, the thing that we see a lot is altitude bus, track deviations, you know. But then the other things that will show up are problems at airports with signage. We'll get a lot of reports where people are having runway incursions. Well, there might be a reason, because there's a sign that's not visible, or it's, you know, it's ambiguous or something. So those things will pop up, and then we'll do an alert on those. And we alert the FAA and or a manufacturer if there's an airplane problem.
How about the volume of issues that get reported?
5,000 a month.
Wow, that's a lot. Is there a trend? Are they increasing, decreasing?
Well, we had a big jump up. We were averaging about 3,000 a month until the airlines ASAP program, which is an in-house.
Right, yes.
Those automatically come to us. And then the air traffic controllers also started that same system. And they have an in-house program, but they all come to NASA as the clearinghouse that sees the whole broad spectrum of aviation, you know, from general aviation and maintenance and air traffic control and airlines. Everything comes through us. Okay, we also have a monthly safety newsletter that comes out from NASA. It's called Callback, and it's free, and all you have to do is enter your email address, and then it comes to your email once a month.
And what sort of topics are covered in the newsletter?
It's excerpts from reports that we get in, and it'll be geared to a certain theme each month. Like this one happens to be the confusion with RNP approaches and stuff.
Okay, sure. All right, very good. Thanks. And where can folks find out more about this program online?
At asrs.arc.nasa.gov.
Great. Thank you very much. I'm at the AviLoop booth, and who am I speaking with?
Nadia Marcinko. I'm the CEO of the company.
And Nadia, what is AviLoop? What is that all about?
AviLoop is a daily deal website for the aviation community. So we offer deals on things like flight lessons or airplane accessories, maintenance, fuel, FBO services, anything to do with the aviation.
And is this a new site, or has this been operating for a while?
It's a very new site, only a couple months old.
Oh, really? And how's it going so far?
It's going great. We're getting a lot of interest from pilots and actually the businesses as well.
And where do people find out more about AviLoop?
You can go to our website at www.aviloop.com.
And are you on Twitter or any other social media outlets?
We're on Twitter at AviLoop Deals, and we have a Facebook fan page, AviLoop.
Now, what was sort of the genesis of this idea?
Well, I'm a pilot myself. I'm a flight instructor, and I always heard students complaining about the cost. It's not a surprise. Yeah. Everyone knows that aviation costs a lot, so we're trying to help out.
So you had this idea, and then you thought you'd put together this website, and off you went. So you're a pilot. What? Tell me about your flying.
I fly a G2, Gulfstream 2. It's actually a funny story. I was a model, and I was afraid of flying, so I took a flying lesson, and it worked. Got over it.
And how long have you been flying?
About 3 years.
Well, good. Thank you for speaking with us. And again, tell us the name of the website address.
www.aviloop.com.
Perfect. Thank you. Have a great show.
Thank you.
I'm with Chris Donald from the Big South Fork Air Park. Hi, Chris. How's it going?
Good. How's it going?
Very nice. It's been a great show so far. Yeah. So tell us about the air park. Where is it? What's it all about?
We're in East Tennessee, 50 nautical miles north of Knoxville, Tennessee. We're on 450 acres. We have our own equestrian facility, 5,500-foot runway with four instrument approaches, fuel maintenance on the field, and we've had about 25 lots sold, three within the last 60 days.
Wow, that's fantastic. How long has the air park been in existence?
for about 4 years now.
Okay, and what sorts of folks are attracted to air parks like this?
Generally, we get couples that the husband flies, the wife likes horses or outdoor activities. Just generally the outdoor enthusiasts, stuff like that.
Well, you know, it's interesting on my website, 30,000feet.com, where I have a residential air park section. It's interestingly enough, it's one of the most popular areas of the website. Air parks are really fairly, you know, common and pervasive in this country, aren't they?
Yeah, it's an old idea, but we're getting a lot of increased activity. A lot of people like looking into retirement homes, second homes, stuff like that. So it's going pretty well for us so far.
And how does it work? I mean, if you've got a whole community of people that have a common interest, share something in common, like aviation, like flying, yeah. I mean, the community must be fairly strong.
Yeah, it's a tight-knit community, as young as it is so far. A lot of camaraderie, of course, with the pilots and just great friends that we've found so far.
Now, are there community activities?
Community activities, yeah. We get together. We just had our air show there. Happens every year, September 10th. So, yeah, everybody gets together and has fun.
An air show. So what kind of activities are at the air show?
The air show, obviously. We have a lot of static displays. Remote Air Medical from Knoxville comes up with their DC-3. They come up and do a parachute jump and stuff like that. It's just a day-long event. Some old cars were there this year. But for the most part, all of our customers fly in. They stay at their house and just hang out for the weekend.
Sounds like an awful lot of fun. Well, yeah. Chris, thanks a lot. Tell folks where they can find more about the air park, the website.
Our website is www.bsfairpark.com, where they can call us at 877-BSF-PARK.
Great. Thanks, Chris.
All right. Thanks a lot.
I'm talking with Ronald Jarman. He operates a flight school down in Florida. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
What's the name of the school?
Island Air Express in Panama City, Florida.
And you're a certified flight instructor?
Yes, sir. Certified for private and instrument, multi, and we can do ATP as well, too.
Now, how long have you been flying?
I've been flying for more than 10 years.
Yeah, and what sort of aircraft do you have down there at the school?
We have Cessna, Piper, and we also have Symphony as well, too.
Ah, very nice. Now, you know, on the podcast, we've talked about the costs of getting your pilot's license a lot. It's an issue that comes up frequently. Do you find that with your students, too? Are they struggling to make this an affordable activity?
Yes, exactly. And we've been a little creative on our end because of the fact that we're getting one of the sky catchers, and we'll be down in a range of about $3,000 for the private pilot.
Wow, that's pretty reasonable. You know, another thing that we've talked about on the show has been the dropout rate, that nationwide a lot of students who start down that path, you know, fall out for one reason or another. Have you seen that as well?
Yes, and, you know, and what's happening is the funding is dried up. But there are some banks that are going to start lending, as well as we got some other solutions right in our community that we're working with as well, be able to help students if they come to work with us.
Tell us a little bit about the students. What kinds of folks are coming to see you? Are they old, young, professional, not? What, you know, aspirations to be commercial pilots or want to be private pilots? What do you see coming into through your doors?
Right now, we're... We have a variety of people that are coming in the doors. We have students that are in high school that are training with us. We also have some professional people that are training with us because of the fact that to start a new career is what they call it. But we got that in-between person that do want to become an airline pilot and just finding the means of accomplishing their goals, and we're trying to help them do that.
Well, fantastic. Ronald, where can folks find out more about you and what you do? Do you have a website that folks can look at?
Yes, sir. It's called islandairexpress.com, as well as you can call me on 850-251-4181.
All right, Ronald, thank you very much, and enjoy the show.
Thank you, sir. You have a blessed one.
I'm with Carl Dietrich from Terra Fugic. I last spoke with Carl at the Simsbury fly-in in Connecticut a year ago. Carl, the vehicle looks a little bit different than it did a year ago. What's been going on?
Well, this is Terra Fugic's production prototype transition rotable aircraft, and so it is substantially different than our proof-of-concept vehicle, which is what we had at the Simsbury fly-in. There have been a number of improvements since the proof-of-concept. For one, we no longer have the canard in front.
Right, I noticed that difference.
Yeah, there's a larger diameter propeller, and the rear is opened up. We now have a blown stabilator in the back, so a larger wing area with an improved airfoil on the main wing. So overall, it's a sleeker design. We think it's more attractive in general than what the proof of concept was, and should give us better performance.
It, you know, you're right. It does have kind of a curvier a look to it. That's kind of very satisfying.
Yeah. Yeah, no, the part of the development of the production prototype, we worked with some industrial designers that helped us refine the look of the vehicle.
Now, you've recently gotten some waivers from the FAA and the DOT that have made kind of life quite a bit easier for you.
Absolutely, yeah. The FAA allowed us an additional 110 pounds, similar to the amphibious light sport aircraft, but still to be classified as a light sport aircraft. So that's very helpful because we're also trying to meet federal motor vehicle safety standards, and we have to add a lot of equipment into the vehicle in order to meet those standards. We have airbags, drivers and passenger side airbags, explosive retractors on the seat belts. We have a safety cage. We have a crumple zone. We have lighting for automotive requirements. There's a lot of stuff that goes into the vehicle to make it meet those federal motor vehicle safety standards, and it all weighs something.
And you've got a great location here at the show. The airplane is the vehicle here. Oh, what do you call it?
We call it the transition. We just try or
just
a street legal airplane or a flying car. You can call it whatever you want.
So I'm sure you're going to get a lot of traffic, a lot of folks interested in looking at this. So, well, it looks gorgeous. Where are we now in the development cycle?
The transition is about to begin its production prototype testing program. So we have about a year of flight and drive testing to get under our belt before we're going to feel comfortable delivering a product.
All right, well, we'll look forward to that. Thanks a lot, Carl, and enjoy the show.
Thanks very much for talking.
I'm speaking with Randy from Frasca International. You're a flight simulator company?
That's correct. Frasca was founded in 1958, so we've been around for 53 years. Currently, we have over 2,000 devices worldwide in 70 different countries. And we manufacture a full range from a single-seat advanced aviation training device up to a full-flight simulator. And we're pretty diverse. So we'll do general aviation, business, airlines, military, helicopters, you name it. After being around for 53 years, we get pretty spread out. So
now, what's the process for creating a new product or updating one to include certain kinds of aircraft? I mean, how do you go about incorporating, the relevant features of an airplane into a physical flight simulator?
Well, there's a couple of different ways. One of that is we have to listen to our customer requirements, what they really need and want as far as their training requirements go. We do a number of different ways to integrate, especially advanced avionics. A lot of times, typically, we prefer to use the actual avionics and do what we call stimulate them, which is actually use the boxes and use our simulation and our host software to that way incorporate and integrate the avionics. That way, your fit, form, function is exactly the same.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Do the avionics manufacturers just give you the equipment or do you have to buy it on the market like everyone else?
Unfortunately, we're like everybody else. So we actually are qualified as avionics dealers because of the amount of avionics that we buy from Garmin and Avidyne. But we have to purchase them just the same way everybody else does. So no breaks there, which is part of the reason sometimes the cost escalates a little bit depending on that. But especially nowadays, especially with a lot of the PFDs and MFDs that are out there, a lot of times we also do what is called simulating them, which is essentially designing them using computer graphics, images, and essentially recreating the operating logic of the system as well.
Is there anything happening in the flight simulation, industry that things that we can look forward to, or are we in a pretty stable period right now?
I think there are a number of enhancements that are coming out. Generally, most of the, you know, our simulators are governed by the FAA regulations, so a lot of those things are not going to change very rapidly as far as that goes. But enhancements, like we're doing a lot of voice recognition, voice triggers and things like that. So as the pilot gets to the taxiway and he says, ready for departure, runway 4R, Tower will come back and say, November 1234, roger, runway 4R, cleared for takeoff, without the instructor having to key anything or do anything. So we're looking at a lot of automated features, scenario-based training and planning that incorporate some FITS curriculum in there as well, too. So especially with all the transition to glass avionics, that seems to be a major feature that a lot of people are looking for nowadays.
All right. Well, very good. Where can our listeners who are interested in learning more about Frasca find you guys?
Well, they can find us at www.frasca.com. We're based in Champaign, Illinois, East Central Illinois, about 130 miles south of Chicago. And you can find us on the Internet or give us a call. Either way, we'll be happy to talk to you.
Great. And that's Frasca, FRASCA.com. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Max.
All right. Enjoy the show.
You too.
I'm standing in front of the 4Flight booth, and while I was waiting to talk to somebody from 4Flight, I ran across Clay Murphy. Clay, I understand you're a 4Flight user.
I am. I've been using 4Flight for about 6 or 7 months. Most of the flying that we do, I'm from Florida, is VFR, but the different maps allows me to use it in a versatile way. I'm constantly using it. I actually use this thing just every time I fly, either for planning or actual in-flight information.
Now, did you fly up for this event?
We did.
And did you use, was 4Flight part of your the process?
It was part of my process from a couple weeks ago when I started planning.
Tell us about that, yeah. Tell us about the planning and how that this product is sort of affected the way that you do that.
Well, I'm kind of a planning geek anyway. I love to pull the maps out and stuff like this. But what this app on my iPad allowed me to do is to go in and look at information on my 4Flight app, and then pop out into the AOPA app and download information about airports, and then go over to Safari and download information from NavAir about fuel prices, and then go back to 4Flights and chart it on the map. It was really easy, and a lot easier than having different applications laid out on a table. I had it all on one device. So
now, are you a computer guy, or is this something new?
No, I'm a wannabe computer guy.
Just an average guy.
I'm just an average guy, but my iPad has really helped me out with planning and actual in-flight stuff that I never had before. I've been flying about 16, 17 years and got about 2,500 hours. But this has opened up my flying from regional to nationwide. We went to Long Beach last year in our little Aero, and my buddy and I are here in Connecticut, and we're looking at the weather, and we're using this 4Flight app a lot.
So it sounds like you're a pretty satisfied customer.
You know, when you look at the initial startup costs, you know, you scratch your head and go, wow, you know, how am I going to explain that to my wife? But but I've used it so much and gotten so much out of it that, it's just a non-issue.
All right. Well, great. Thanks. Thanks, Clay, for your comments, and I hope you enjoy the show.
Thank you very much.
So I'm still at the 4Flight booth, and I'm speaking with Jason. Now, how are you associated with this company?
I am one of the co-founders of the company and one of the developers.
And how long ago was 4Flight founded?
We founded the company in 2007, about 2 weeks before the iPhone came out. And so the iPhone kind of fell in our laps, and we jumped on it.
Yeah, good timing.
Yeah, it was dumb luck, but perfect, yeah.
Now, what was sort of the genesis of this idea? Where did this come from, or what were you guys trying to accomplish?
Yeah, so my co-founder Tyson Weiss and I had both been independently developing aviation software apps, kind of to solve our own problems. Basically just wanted to get weather quickly. And we wanted it to be translated for us so we didn't have to read the METAR codes and all that type of stuff. So we eventually decided that we should maybe start working together. And, you know, like I said, the iPhone came out a couple of weeks later. We weren't really sure what direction we were going to go, maybe web, we weren't sure. And when we saw that, Tyson ran out to the, I think he went to the AT&T store, grabbed an iPhone. He said, this is what we're doing.
This is it.
Yeah, it was an easy decision then. So we ended up developing a web-based app for the iPhone. That was before Apple had the App Store at all. And had some good early success with that, enough to get on Apple's radar. They gave us some early access to the SDK when it came out, and from then on, we've just been all about the Apple code.
Any other devices in the future, Android or anything else?
Yeah, we're really interested in the Android landscape. We're looking to see those tablets develop more. We've been investigating it pretty heavily. The Windows stuff is really impressive. You know, the market's not really quite there yet, but you know, at least from a technical side, I hope it gets there because it looks really nice.
Yeah, good, good. What about the demographics of your customers? What are your typical customers like?
Well, a lot of our customers is probably 80% piston engine guys, either twins or singles, and then about the other 20% is turbines. We've got guys from, you know, lots of professional pilots, lots of weekend flyers, lots of students. We really run the gamut, you know. So, yeah.
Okay, and people can probably find 4Flight at, I'm going to take a guess and say, 4Flight.com?
That's an excellent guess, yeah. foreflight.com, that's right.
All right, thanks a lot.
Appreciate it. I appreciate it, Max. Thank you.
Well, I've found the Civil Air Patrol, and I'm here with a couple of guys. And tell us your name.
Lieutenant Colonel Tony Valillo of Connecticut Wing.
And
Major Steve Rocchetto, Thames River Composite Squadron.
Fantastic. Now, the Civil Air Patrol, for those few listeners that aren't familiar with that organization, maybe you can just give us a brief rundown.
Well, Civil Air Patrol is the official auxiliary of the United States Air Force. Our missions involve just about all inland search and rescue, and also disaster relief, homeland security, counter-drug in the flying and operational end. Then we also have a complete cadet program and an aerospace education program, both for the cadets and to the community at large.
Tell me a little bit more about the cadet program. I mean, we're always interested on the show in helping young people get involved and interested in aviation. So how does that program work in that way?
Our cadet program accepts youth between the ages of 12, and they can be in the program up to the age 21. It's basically a four-part program involving aerospace education, physical training, character development, and leadership training. Very much like a series of Air Force ranks, much like the Boy Scouts, although the cadets are actually charged with actually going on real missions later when they qualify under certain regulations and rules. They also get flight training if they wish. Each cadet will have up to 10 hours of free flight training. If they solo an aircraft, either through our National Flight Academy or through a commercial operator, they can continue and get their private pilot license with us using Civil Air Patrol instructors and Civil Air Patrol aircraft at a fairly low rate.
Well, that's fascinating. Do you have any idea roughly how many cadets are in the program right now?
In Connecticut, we have about 300 cadets. I believe there's probably around 30,000 nationally.
Wow, that's spectacular. That's very good. How do you reach out to prospective cadets to get them interested?
A lot of it is word of mouth. We have some programs in schools. We have a group called Aerospace Education Specialists who are teachers in schools, and our local squadron, for example, at Thames River, we work with two elementary schools running aerospace programs after school.
Very good. Fascinating. Now, in order to join the Civil Air Patrol, what are the requirements? How do you go about doing that? Or what kind? Do you have to be a pilot?
Well, not at all. In fact, here in Connecticut, out of about 400 members, we have about 60 or so that are pilots. The process of joining begins locally, as an individual might go and attend a meeting at one of the squadrons. There are 12 of them here in Connecticut, located either on airports or in other locations in the center of town, sometimes at armories and so on. And the actual application process, part of which is online, involves filling out the application. There's a background check. Fingerprints are taken because, of course, our members are working with young people and cadets. A pilot, of course, once they join Civil Air Patrol and qualify through some of the initial training, which is taken online, general Civil Air Patrol orientation, would then go to their squadron and start flying with an instructor pilot to get their flying skills polished up to the level where they could take their check ride. CAP is like the Air Force in the sense that it requires an annual proficiency check, and that check is essentially a complete private pilot check ride every year to retain your airplane qualifications.
And we need all kinds of skills. For example, in our squadron, we have people who work with the cadet program, aerospace education specialists. We also have people running in finance, working with ground search teams, working with public affairs. There's a whole range of activities that are open to anyone who has interest in working with us.
All right, very good. So if people are interested in learning more about the CAP, where can they go?
We can go to a website which we have. The website's address is gocivilairpatrol.com. If you're in Connecticut, Google the Connecticut Wing Civil Air Patrol, and you can get information on the wing itself. When you put in your zip code on some of these sites, they'll tell you which squadrons are near you with phone numbers or email addresses so you can contact a representative.
All right, very good. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
I'm with Linda Meeks from Girls with Wings. Hi, Linda.
Hi.
Now, we've talked about Girls with Wings actually many times on the podcast, but for our listeners who are not familiar with Girls with Wings, can you tell us a little bit about it?
Girls with Wings is a nonprofit organization to encourage more girls to have an interest in aviation, and we do this with various outreach activities like presentations to girls groups. We also have an interactive website, and we do scholarships every year for flying lessons.
Scholarships, that's interesting. How many scholarships do you give out? And how do you select the winners of the recipients for those scholarships?
Well, we have a very special selection process. We're actually giving out the scholarships for women who feel that they would make a good role model for Girls with Wings. That's one of the focuses of our organization, is to inspire girls to reach their full potential. So we always ask for an essay that describes how the women feel that they can best do that.
And what age groups are you looking at?
For the presentation?
No, just in general. I mean,
general?
Yeah.
Well, it's kind of funny because we have mission creep. I think that the presentation that we do is best suited for 4th through 6th graders. Unfortunately, because once girls get to about the 7th grade, they get that self-confidence issue and everything.
Oh, yes.
But we do try to reach out to all ages. We also get a good portion of our support from women who are just learning to fly. They're really excited about spreading the word about what it is they're doing. So we really focus on encouraging women to network and support each other.
Women, I think, have been underrepresented in aviation in general, maybe particularly with respect to pilots. Are we making some headway? Is that changing, do you think?
It's so funny that you said that, because I just had a guy in the booth that was talking about how much more he hears women on the radio now. So I had to tell him that it's still just 6% of pilots, and you could have knocked him over because he was so surprised. But that's something, especially at AOPA, I hear a lot of, is the increase in women pilots, and unfortunately it really hasn't increased.
What can we do?
Well, again, that's one of the things about Girls with Wings, is I'm trying to start them young. We've got the Penelope pilot book that is perfect for, you know, 2, 3, 4 year olds on up, and we just really try to encourage girls to grow up knowing that this is an option for them.
Now, the Girls with Wings website?
We do have the website. It's one of the main focuses on it is we have 87 bios on there of women in different fields of aviation. So people can go there, click on the woman's picture, see what it is she does, how she got to that point, and then send her an email if they have any further questions or if it's something that they're interested in doing themselves.
Wow, I'm going to check that out, because that may be a good list of potential guests on the podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
That's fun. Now, you have a lot of merchandise here at the booth, I see. Is that T-shirts and lots of other things? Are those available on the website as well?
Yes, they are. And that's people always ask me why I started Girls with Wings, and mostly a lot of it was because I have nieces, and I was never able to buy them anything with an airplane on it like I could for my nephews. And that's kind of how the whole thing started. But then I had to ask myself later, okay, why aren't we making things with airplanes on it for girls? There's a bigger issue here, so...
You mentioned Penelope before, and I've seen that, but why don't you kind of describe what that's about?
Penelope Pilot is our mascot. It's the first in a series of Girls with Wings characters that we're going to bring out representing the different fields of aviation. But what we're hoping to do is kind of have a club kind of character for it, where the girls interact so we can be educational as well as entertain the girls. Because, as one of our taglines go, girls need flight plans, not fairy tales.
Oh, I love that. I love that. Can people just make donations to the group?
Absolutely. Please do. We are a 501c3 organization. So not only are we looking for donations, we're looking for volunteers all of the time. I live in Cleveland, Ohio, but we do have representatives around the country because we're constantly getting requests from people to have a women pilot come and talk to girls.
Do you mostly look for female volunteers, or can men volunteer as well?
Actually, it's really great because some of our biggest supporters are men. Why? Because they have daughters and they see that their daughters aren't afforded the same opportunities as they were growing up. So, yeah, we can use any help that we can get.
All right, you guys out there listening, pay attention. Listen to what Linda has to say. All right. Thanks again, Linda.
Thank you very much.
So I'm walking along some booths here, and my eye was caught by this big banner. It says, Patient Airlift Services, Volunteer Pilots Needed. So I'm not familiar with this organization, so I'm here with Eileen. Can you tell us a little bit about this?
Sure. We're a volunteer pilot organization, and we are a part of the Air Care Alliance. We're pilots who volunteer their time, pay for fuel, and just leave their family and help us when we call them and ask them to take a family that needs to get treatment, chemotherapy treatment, whether it's a wounded warrior. There's a number of reasons why we might need a flight to take place.
And how extensive is this organization? How many pilots or how many flights are you operating?
Sure. We're probably one of the youngest public benefit flying organizations. We started in May of 2010. We have over 150 pilots. We fly the Northeast United States, and we've flown over 600 flights in our first year.
Wow, that's quite a lot. Can you characterize the types of people that you've carried?
Absolutely. We have medical flights, which could be a 3-year-old from Virginia that needs to come to New York for chemotherapy treatment, or a single mom who was driving her daughter down from upstate New York to Long Island, New York, and was driving 6 hours, and now we do it in 45 minutes. We've flown wounded veterans who were coming in for, we work with the Wounded Warrior Project and Hope for the Warriors. And then we've done compassion flights for a mom and dad whose son was away at college and he was in a car accident. He was in critical condition for 53 days and the dad needed to sustain his job. So he had to go back and forth from one state to another. And we were able to fly him on the weekends so that he could spend quality time with his son and not 4 hours in a car, especially when they're in intensive care. That's every moment counts, and that's the way we believe the mission should be. Every moment counts.
That's wonderful. That's really fantastic. Now, the pilots are not medical professionals.
No, we're not an air ambulance. They're your everyday general aviation pilots. That's why I love to be here and express the good things that general aviation is doing with all the craziness that's being said about it. Every day, planes are going up in the air, and a pilot is doing good. Our slogan is changing lives one flight at a time, and these pilots literally are.
What is it, if you are a pilot, what qualifications do you need in order to participate in this?
Sure. Well, we have a number of different ways. We're trying to engage pilots in any way that they might feel that they can get involved. To be a pilot in command, they have to have 500 hours, be IFR rated. All the qualifications are on our website, but we encourage anybody who's interested, whether they're 300 hours and getting their IFR, that they can get involved because we have co-pilots, we have mission assistants, even if it's something as simple as introducing us to an organization that might need our services. Awareness is just as important as the flights themselves.
Now, I see you're standing next to a big sign that says free fuel. What does that mean?
Well, Patient Airlift Services applied to the FAA for a waiver to reimburse our pilots for fuel, and it was granted. So we're one of three organizations that have been given this exemption, and we put together a program where if any of the pilots fit the criteria, and that's all on our website at palservices.org, They can figure out what whether or not they want to fit into that criteria. And if they do, then if they just have to do two flights with PALS, and then we'll reimburse them 100% of their fuel for our flights, as long as they fit the FAA waiver. There's an affirmation that they have to fill out, but we're trying our hardest to get more flights flown and help more people.
Now, you concentrate in the Northeast United States. What about people that need transportation in other regions? Do you work with other groups?
Absolutely, and we're a big friend of and we're a big proponent of the Air Care Alliance. It's a national organization that other wonderful organizations such as ours that do the same thing. We're not the only ones out there, and we link with them as well. Our friends in Angel Flight Georgia, we link with them, and Angel Flight Central. There's Angel Flight West out in out in California, and we're just thankful to be a part of the Air Care Alliance because it's an amazing national organization.
Well, as our friend Martha Stewart would say, this is a really good thing.
Oh, thank you. I feel very fortunate to have the conversations that I do with people. I am not a pilot, and I feel I'm in awe of every pilot that is generous enough to do what they're doing on a daily basis. And we literally change lives one flight at a time, and I'm very happy to be able to stand here and have conversations with anyone who will listen to me.
Now, besides pilots who can donate their time and their aircraft, what about other people? How can they help?
That's a great point, because most of my pilots, especially my board, I have a completely all-volunteer board, and they do not feel that we've gone full circle if we do not get a patient from the airport to their hospital or their treatment facility or their housing facility. So we need volunteer, we call them autopilots. We need volunteer autopilots to do the ground transportation. So all these applications are on our website at palservices.org, and we're looking for anyone who wants to get involved. We feel that it's a team effort. We love to hear people, comments, criticisms, introductions to other organizations. We fully believe that collaborating is the best way to help more people.
Fantastic. And that's palservices.com. That's the website.
.org.
.org. Sorry. .org. Yep. Get that right.
Yes, .org. That's important. So,
Anywhere else?
They can call the telephone number at 888-818-1231, and or they can just send an email to info@PALServices.org.
Very good. Thank you, Eileen.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
I was walking past the King Schools booth, and since John and Martha had been on the podcast previously, I was hoping I could stop in, say hello. But they're not here right now. They're going to show up later in the event. But instead, I found this guy named Alex, who seems maybe even more interesting than John and Martha. Hi, Alex.
How you doing?
Good. Now, you work for King Schools.
I do. I've worked for King Schools since July of 2008.
And what do you do for King Schools?
I work in the outbound sales department. I talk to pilots. I see where they're at in their flying. I tailor make a package that fits them and addresses their needs, and I try to make it work for them so we don't include any extraneous information that they don't need, so they get the absolute best value.
Tell me about the kinds of people that come to King Schools looking for instruction. Can you tell us about the demographics?
Absolutely. We have a really wide range of customers. We deal with everything from people that have never even been in an airplane or gone flying, all the way up to pilots that have many thousands of hours that need advanced jet training. We have RVSM courses and stuff like that, and we've also got the basic sport pilot stuff. So I deal with all sorts of pilots, and you kind of have to put a different hat on for each person that you're dealing with, but that's a part of the job that I really enjoy.
Now, do you treat them all as, customers that you want to grab? Or, do you do any kind of vetting of, their desire to become a pilot?
I try to approach customers, King Schools customers, as fellow pilots rather than a customer. Because the way I look at the aviation community, we got to stay together here because, we're threatened on all, we've got rising costs, we've got government regulation and all sorts of things that could be potential problems. But I try to approach each customer in a way that is fitting to who they are. So I try to, you used a good word, vetting. I try to be as custom as I can with them. And in terms of that, I try to make them feel at home, and I try to, like I said, treat them as a fellow pilot first, and I'm looking out for their interests.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Now, do you fly yourself?
I do fly.
And what do you fly?
I just fly 172.
What do you mean just? There's no just. But if it's anything, it's good, right?
That's a good way to put it.
And how long have you been flying? When did you get your license?
I started flying in 2008, got my license in 2010.
Okay, so fairly recent. Mm-hmm. Did you go through King Schools or did you learn through someone else?
I used the King Schools to prepare for my written exam, but I had someone else sign me off, though, because I'm an employee, so.
Yeah. Now, are you employed by King Schools full-time?
No, I'm not. In fact, I work for King Schools. I worked for them during the last summer and prior to that. But during the school year, I'm attending Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University, and I'm studying global security and intelligence.
Oh, fantastic. So Embry-Riddle is obviously a well-known school in the aviation arena. What's going on at Embry-Riddle these days? Anything, any trends you see?
Well, let's see. I'm in my second year at the university, and we've actually got a good number of new students enrolling this year. Last year when I started, it was kind of low, and they were a little bit worried about that. But this year we've got a lot of new people coming in. What's happening at the school, though, it's kind of trending towards engineering now. They're really having a very heavy focus, and I don't remember the exact name of the award, but we were on some best colleges list for 2011 in terms of, I believe, engineering was the focus for that. So we've got a great engineering program there, and, you know, unfortunately, it's kind of been trending that way versus the aeronautical science portion, which is the pilot track, you know, if you want to be a professional pilot.
Right. Now, you know, on the Airplane Geeks podcast, we sort of have a long history of trying to, you know, help get people interested in aviation. Oftentimes young people.
Mm-hmm.
Where did your interest come from?
It's a very good question. In fact, my father was a flight instructor, so it was kind of bred, you know, within me from the beginning. My dad started flying in the 70s, and he didn't tell his parents anything until he had his license and taken his check ride and said, oh, I'm a pilot. Yeah. So, because he knew they would have freaked out. But, you know, I can remember my earliest memories of, there's always pictures of airplanes on the walls, there's always models on the top of the bookshelves, and just my whole life I've been kind of saturated with it, but I like it, so, and it's you know, it's a part of me that I don't want to get rid of, so.
Yeah. That's great, that's fun. Any advice for young people?
Any advice for young people? Well, kind of putting me on the spot there. My advice, I would say you need to follow what you want to do in your life, and you need to weigh things out very carefully and think of the future, because I know too many people my age that they're thinking 20 minutes ahead when you need to be at least having a picture of 20 years. So that's the best advice I can give, is plan for the future and listen to what you want versus what people tell you that you want.
I think that's really wise advice from someone who's relatively young, I'll say, so very good. So just one last question, what do you see in your future?
I'm not exactly sure. Like I said, I'm doing the intelligence degree. My minor is business. I think I have a lot of interest in business. I think I'd like to go that route. I'd like to either be management or maybe Wall Street, something like that. I'm not exactly sure.
Aviation or not necessarily?
You know what? If I could be in the aviation industry, that would be a plus, but it's not a deal breaker. Yeah. So I got to keep myself flexible in this changing economy here. Best way I can put it is that my generation, we're going to be more free agents, whereas previous generations, they signed on the company, and they were there till they got their gold watch. Well, I'm going to have to be a little bit more diverse and versatile than that. So that's my plan.
Good for you. I think you've got a great plan. Well, Alex, again, thanks for speaking with us. King Schools, people can find out more at kingschools.com, right?
That's correct. Kingschools.com. Got all the information on our products there. You can view demos and everything.
And how about you personally? Do you have an online presence or someplace where people can go watch you?
You can check me out on Instagram. I like to post pictures. I don't know. It's kind of growing. It's still pretty small. That's where I am. Unfortunately, I don't really use Twitter, and my Facebook is private. But you can check out my pictures on Instagram. There's cool pictures of airplanes and some architecture and stuff like that that I'm into. I'm also into BMWs. So there's a good amount of photos of that. And you can just search TOCK172. That's my username.
Very good. Thanks again, Alex.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
I'm looking at some seatbelt airbags. Now, these are not automotive airbags. This is for use in an aircraft. I'm in front of the AmSafe booth. I'm talking with Steve.
Hi.
Steve, tell me about these airbags here. These are seatbelt-based airbags.
We call it a seatbelt airbag. We originally developed these in the late 1990s and first certified them in 2001 for commercial air transport. Then we moved on to general aviation, which is what we have here at the AOPA show. And we're standard equipment on all Cessna single-engine piston aircraft since 2005. We're standard on the Cirrus aircraft, primarily in the pilot co-pilot positions. And we have STCs for over 180 different models of general aviation aircraft for retrofit.
Wow.
So that's quite a few. That covers something like 180,000 aircraft. The system is a completely self-contained system. It doesn't hook up to aircraft electrical in any way. We have about 70,000 of these installed out in the field, over 300 million flight hours. And one of the questions I always get asked is, well, what about in turbulence or hard landings? Will that cause it to go off? And I can tell you with 300 million flight hours and 70,000 of these installed, we've never had an inadvertent deployment during takeoff or landing or during flight. So it is a very safe system.
Any idea roughly how many deployments you've seen?
You know, I don't have the total number offhand. It's in the hundreds. And as you can see, this is an FAA brochure that was put out up in Alaska where they talked about analyzing accidents that occurred between 2005 and 2010. And out of all the accidents, there was 113 fatalities. And in their opinion, according to this brochure, 50 of them may have been preventable had they had airbags. So there's a lot of benefits to it.
Right, and these are not designed to allow you to survive an accident that's not survivable, right?
That's exactly right. A lot of people say, well, how's that going to help me at 200 knots straight in? And obviously it's not going to help you. It's got to be a survival crash. But we have our own test sled in Phoenix, which is our main headquarters, and we ran upwards of 600 test sleds a year on our products, which is both seatbelts as well as seatbelt airbags. We also do a lot of testing with other people's seats. So we have quite a bit of experience in the benefits of not only airbags, but also in the restraint business. AmSafe produces about 90% of all the world's aviation seatbelts.
That's amazing. Now, maybe you can describe the technology that's used to inflate these bags.
It's based on automotive technology. In fact, we have a number of automotive engineers on our staff. To begin with, we started with the airbag itself, which is a material that's very similar to what's used in automotive airbags. But our design's a little bit different. In the automotive environment, the airbag comes out of the steering wheel or out of the dash and comes at you. And in many cases, it actually causes injury. In the case of our airbag, on a three-point or a two-point lap belt, the airbag is built into the lap. So when the airbag inflates, it comes straight up in front of you like a shield. And it actually provides a barrier between you and the various strike hazards like control columns, glare shields, etc. On a four- or five-point, like you might see on a Cirrus or even an agricultural aircraft, our airbag is built into one side of the shoulder harness, and when it opens across and in front. And again, it provides a barrier to prevent strike hazards from the head or for torso. The system itself is powered by an inflator, which is a 6,000 PSI cylinder of compressed helium argon gas.
And that's a pretty small cylinder, right? That looks like it's maybe about, I don't know, 10 or 12 inches long and maybe an inch and a half or something in diameter?
Exactly. And the whole system, by the way, adds about 2.5 pounds per seat. So in terms of weight, that's what you'll be looking at. We have one inflator per seat airbag, and we have one electronic module, which can power up to three seats. Obviously, in a GA environment for pilot, co-pilot powers just the two of them. And this, as I said, is self-contained. This gets mounted to the airframe, usually under the seat or underneath the floor, mounted to structure. This basically needs to see what the airframe sees. So at approximately 9 Gs, a forward impact, there's two sensors in here, they make contact, send an electrical signal to the inflator, releases the gas, airbag inflates, and all of that happens literally in 50 milliseconds. Very, very fast acting.
That's interesting. Now, the website people can learn more is amsafe.com.
Amsafe.com, or you can also go to gaairbags.com, and we've got listings of all the aircraft we have STCs for. We also distribute our product directly through our service centers. We have over 700 of them worldwide. And there's all of our videos are there, too, including a couple of testimonials from people that have actually been in accidents where they felt the airbags made a difference between them walking away without any injuries and being seriously injured. So
That's great. Are there any commercial aviation applications of this technology? Are we seeing any of that?
Absolutely. In fact, the vast majority, I mentioned earlier, we have about 70,000 of these installed out in the field. About two-thirds of those are in commercial aviation. We're on everything from an Airbus A380 on down to an RJ aircraft. Basically, you'll find these as a result of regulations, FAA regulations. You'll find them in bulkhead seats, and you'll also find them in exit row seats. Okay, and then we have a few applications where it's actually located in every seat of the airplane. So, of course, that's what we'd like to see. But in terms of FAA requirements, there is some new regulations that came out in October that speak to strike hazards. And that's one of the reasons why the airlines, particularly on newer aircraft, are all installing the airbags and the bulkheads and also in exit rows, because the bulkhead or the seat in front of the exit row represents a strike hazard.
Well, fantastic. Thank you very much, Steve Marshall. The website is amsafe.com, amsafe.com. Thanks for talking with us. Enjoy the show.
Thank you, Max.
Thank you for listening to this special edition of the Airplane Geeks podcast. You can find all our episodes as well as show notes at airplanegeeks.com. Our email address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And we also have a listener line where you can leave us an audio message. That number is 361-GEEKS-01. Opening and closing music is provided by Brother Love. Find him at www.brotherloverocks.com.